Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on iTunes or download our podcasts from restaurantguysradio.com.
Hey there, Mark. How are you?
I'm great, Francis. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, and I want to talk about a very salient topic. I want to talk about photography in restaurants.
I thought you were going to talk about salt. I guess I got the meaning of that word wrong.
That'd be a saline topic.
Oh, that'd be a saline topic.
No, how do you feel about photography in restaurants?
Depends. You've seen me take pictures in restaurants.
You've seen me go head-to-head with a restaurant owner who didn't want me taking pictures in his restaurant,
mm-hmm.
and I think handled it wrong.
I think somebody from the New York Times must have heard our radio show.
Maybe there was an article recently. There was an article recently in the Times by Helen Stupinski about this very topic. I have taken pictures in restaurants. I never use a flash, but I have mm-hmm. taken pictures in restaurants. I sometimes take the pictures of the food. Honestly, I sometimes come back and share them with the chef.
Of course,
he does that, and I share them with
you. I do the same. What I always do, though, I'm always discreet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always, making sure that you would have to be really staring at me to know I was taking a picture of something.
I could be looking at my phone,
mm-hmm.
and just the phone happens to be pointing at the dish. So, it's funny, though. I have been in restaurants where it's really obnoxious, especially some of the most expensive and fanciest restaurants around, because it's a very special occasion, and the food is often beautiful. And when you're sitting there having dinner and things are flashing all around you.
Where someone puts a tripod on the table.
Yeah, that's wrong. It's all wrong. It's all wrong. You know what? You're not a food journalist. And you taking a flash picture and you taking a picture where you stand up on the chair and take a picture, you standing up and taking a picture of your food is really distracting.
Mm-hmm.
It's really... impedes the rest of the people in the dining room, even though it's not at your table. It's really annoying.
Well, you've heard us say this a million times on this show. The job of the restaurant is to make sure that your actions don't negatively affect anybody else.
If you're
doing something and it doesn't bother anybody else and it's not affecting the time that they're having in the restaurant, then I don't care what you're doing.
Yep. Well, there's a flow to a room. You know what I mean? It's like there's a feeling in a room, and if people are getting up and flashing pictures, and if a photography shoot is going on at the table next to you,
mm-hmm.
that's really annoying.
Distracting.
It's really
distracting,
and it ruins my evening.
Forget about annoying. It's distracting.
Because restaurants are communal places, and they're centers mm-hmm. of community, and they're where we go to be with other people and enjoy a meal and take sustenance.
Yep.
They're not. It's a different thing now. I do think that if someone wants to discreetly snap a picture, especially with their phone, and it doesn't flash, and you don't use a tripod, and you don't stand up, and you get a couple pictures of food, I don't have a problem with that.
I don't care. I think it's fine. I think it's a compliment to the restaurant, frankly.
Yeah.
I think what you're saying is that you really think a lot of the restaurant. Now, there are people who I think adversely affect their own meal because they're so busy taking pictures of it. You know, and I think this about lots of things. You know, when your wedding photographer is so busy being in perfect picture that nothing real is happening at your wedding because all you're doing is
posing for pictures
every second. I think that affects how nice your wedding is, what the memory of the day. And you have great pictures of the day. But the day wasn't as nice.
Yes, great pictures of a day.
Of a day that was less, not as nice as it should have been. Those kinds of things I think really can get in the way.
Well, when it's convenient, when it's on your phone, when you do it quickly, I have a lot of friends who snap things discreetly. But, you know, there are chefs who are saying no photography in the restaurants. Here's from a recent article by Helen Stupinski in the Times. On a visit to Momofuku Ko, one diner thought nothing of subtly raising her iPhone and snapping a picture of her shaved foie. Like tens of thousands of others, she takes photos of her plates constantly, sometimes to the annoyance of her spouse. And if I followed you on Twitter before, if you keep sending me pictures of what you eat, I will delete you. It just seems very casual at Co., she recalled. The host was wearing jeans, hip-hop was on the playlist, and a 12-year-old was sitting next to them. And this dish was famous and fabulous, and it was beautiful, and it only seemed natural to record it for posterity. Then came the slapdown. A man in the open kitchen asked her to please put her phone away. No photos allowed. I don't
understand that.
I don't get it. Now,
she said it. You know, you got a host in jeans. You got a 12-year-old sitting at the table next to you. It's clearly a casual place.
But even if you don't, I mean, it's a very special restaurant. Some of the best food in Manhattan. But
great food. But clearly you've asked for it to be casual.
But even if it's formal, if I pull out my iPhone and snap a picture without a flash and don't stand up, get the hell away from me. come on. Stop being a prima donna. Uh-huh. I'm sorry. I think that's just too much. Mr. Chang is one of several chefs who either prohibit food photography at Cohen, New York, or now there are other people who have policy against flashes. I think that's perfectly fine.
Yep. You're affecting the other people in the room.
And you know what Thomas Keller does? If he sees people taking a flash picture or trying to stand up, or he's even had people come with tripods and set them up on the table, he says, you know, that would look so much better in the kitchen. And he takes the dish back into the kitchen. So if you want to be a toolbox and go back in the kitchen and take a picture of your dish, you can go back in the kitchen and stand in the kitchen like a moron and take a picture.
To the photo studio that he has set up for you.
And you know what else he has, though? Thomas Keller has professional photos of all the food. And they're better than yours.
He will just give them to you.
I don't understand.
So this leads me to another phenomenon that's been happening in restaurants.
Okay.
And it happens in our restaurant more often than it should.
Okay.
And this is something I have to deal with frequently now.
Okay.
People think it's okay to have a laptop open in the middle of a dining room.
It's not.
And sometimes to show their young child a movie on the laptop in the dining room while they're having. Now, first of all, I think a laptop in the dining room is very disconcerting. It's not a tiny little screen that only you can see. It's a large LED screen that's 12, 15, 17 inches large. And I understand maybe you're dining alone or you brought a child with you who you're trying to distract.
Too bad.
You can't bring a laptop into
a
restaurant
distracting me.
And pop it open. It's rude.
You know, I think there are some places in some restaurants that you can ask, and basically if it's you using a laptop and I seat you in the banquette corner.
We have some corner banquettes that are completely secluded and private.
Right. So your laptop is facing you and the corner. And no one else.
Go for it.
And there's no, like, blue glow.
Right.
Of your
there's
shaking.
No ambient
And that doesn't
light.
Mean you can watch a movie. And put your headphones on. You know? And first of all, I'm sorry that you have to work through dinner. We're happy to have you, you know, and if we can do it discreetly. But if you're at a table in the middle of the dining room, it's a lit-up thing with characters that move around, and I don't want to see your PowerPoint presentation. I do not want to see your PowerPoint presentation.
You know, it's funny because last night in the restaurant, I had a table of six gentlemen who had notebooks and spreadsheets, and they were obviously in a very intense business meeting at one table, and I had a party of one on his laptop, or intending to be on his laptop.
Right.
And the party of one on his laptop was much more obtrusive than the party of six with their spreadsheets and their notebooks and the papers all over the table and the arguing about, you know, what their next, you know, multi-million-dollar deal was.
Because that's human beings having a conversation in a room full of human beings having a conversation. If you stand up a screen in the middle of the table and, you know, you should check with the restaurant. Maybe there's some secluded corner they can put you in. But as another diner, if you're – and we've seen people not only just want to use the laptops themselves, but like you said, entertain their kids and show a movie, maybe without headphones. I don't want to see the – I don't have the TV on in my house when I have dinner. I don't want your TV to be on in the restaurant. I paid for my kids.
And I love the music of The Lion King.
Yeah.
I love it. But, you know, I have my own music playing in the restaurant. I don't need yours on top of it.
But the other thing is that's really not okay, and we talked to a lot of our maitre d' friends and sommelier friends and restaurant friends about this. Guys who come in, or people who come in, it's a party of six, and they're going to have a PowerPoint presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, look, people rent our private dining rooms all the time to show a PowerPoint presentation
Absolutely.
While they eat. That's fantastic. It's your room, closed door. You're all having a meeting together. You're not disturbing anybody else. But you can't sit in a dining room where I'm out with my girlfriend, or I want to ask my girlfriend to marry me, or I took a night off from my work, and I got a babysitter for my kids. I don't want to watch your kids' movie, and I don't want to see your work. And you can't do a PowerPoint presentation in the room with me while I eat dinner.
Some of the PowerPoint presentations are uncomfortable.
Oh, the medical ones?
The medical ones.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah. On what planet do you think showing a picture of that in a dining room is okay to anybody but a doctor? Anyway, so if you have an opinion on laptops in a dining room, or if you disagree with us, we'd love to hear from you. So drop us an email at mark@restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll take your comments, and maybe we'll read some on the air. So stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys, and our guest today is an old friend. Susan McKenna-Grant owns, with her husband, La Petraia in Rada in Chianti in Tuscany region of Italy. She's written a book called Piano, 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 and her new book is called Dinamica, La Petraia, Cucina Sistemica at Kilometer Zero.
Susan, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark and Francis, and thanks for having me back.
It's great to have you back, Susan. For those of our listeners who did not, who have not listened to the La Petraia show, I really encourage you to go and check out one of our old shows. It's an on-site. We have photographs. It's really beautiful. So how are things at La Petraia, Susan?
Well, things are great. They've continued to evolve since you guys were there. I think we've got a white wine in the bottle now, and this year we're looking forward to bottling our red wine for the first time under our name. For the last 4 years, we've been selling our red wine in bulk because the vines are very young still. So this is the first year that we actually made the wine, tasted it, and thought that this is La Petraia wine, red wine. And so this year, for the first time, we have three different red wines that we're going to be putting in the bottle, as well as our fourth vintage of our white. So we're excited about that. Also, since you guys were there, I think maybe when you were there, the last time I was talking about getting sheep, but now we have sheep. So we have a source of dairy now at La Petraia. So we're pretty much entirely self-sufficient. I'm making cheese now, and we're getting milk every day from our sheep. And
that probably doesn't add any work to your day.
No.
I think we need to take a step back and explain to our listeners what La Petraia is all about. Do you want to give it a go, and then I'll just cheerlead from the sideline, Susan?
Yeah, well, La Petraia is, we're located in the Chianti Classico region of Tuscany, which is one of the oldest winemaking regions in Tuscany. Technically, we're called an agriturismo, but what we really are is an entirely self-sufficient farm. And we have four guest rooms, we have a restaurant, we have a cooking school, and everything that our guests eat when they're with us is produced on the property, with the exception of really just three ingredients that I can't live without, which are chocolate, coffee, and some of our flour. We do grow a little bit of grain, but not all of it.
Okay, now let me give you the Francis excited version of what Susan just said. An agriturismo is some sort of an agricultural endeavor in Italy or in Europe where you have guest rooms. You welcome people onto the property to see it. Now, the way that a lot of the agriturismos work, it's like, you know, there's one goat in the back in a farm that used to produce something, and there's a hotel where you can go stay in a nice room, and they'll bring you a Chianti from someplace else. So this is an agriturismo, but this is really an agriturismo. This is a 25-year-old Etruscan farmhouse that was
2,500-year-old.
2,500-year-old
Etruscan property.
Etruscan property, 25-decade-old, 100 years old.
Centuries.
25 centuries.
Math is bad. Anyway, very old farmhouse on the top of the highest hill in the Chianti Classico district of Tuscany.
Yeah.
And it was abandoned for 40 years when you guys took it over.
Yeah.
So this had been a producing farm for the vast majority of 1,500 years when you took it over.
Yeah.
And you took it over as an abandoned, well, kind of a ruin almost, and completely restored it to where now you have orchards and vineyards and pigs and
sheep.
You have sheep and bees to make honey from which you make mead and lavender and a garden where you grow everything and chickens and turkeys and... And you're really the real deal, what the agriturismo is supposed to be.
We are, and in fact, I don't know anywhere else in Italy or the world, really, where you can go to a restaurant and everything that you're eating basically comes from that place. I don't really know. And you know, here where we are in Tuscany and in Italy, basically you can pick up a throne and throw it and hit an agriturismo. I mean, they're right. Just all over the place. But like you said, you're lucky if you can get a bottle of wine that comes from the property. And the original idea of the agriturismo was really what we're doing. But really the reason that we're even different from that is that the level that we're doing it at is not a sort of mom-and-pop, you know, rustic kind of operation. It's actually, you know, the restaurant's a very high-end restaurant, and the rooms are quite luxurious in their sort of minimalist Tuscan simplicity. So that's really what makes us unique and what makes us different.
Mark and I, the year that we visited, which is about 3 or 4 years ago now, the year that we visited, that was the meal we had with you was our best meal of the year. So we're talking about, you know, the level on which you're cooking there as well. I think philosophically, conceptually, it's amazing. I think mechanically, it's amazing. And also, just as a freaking phenomenal restaurant, it was really, I mean,
just everything that goes really on amazing at the property. Francis is talking about, you know, from start to finish, from growing the things that you have on the property and the way you do it and the traditional way you do it. A farmer's life is difficult. A hotelier's life is difficult. A restaurateur's life is difficult. You've taken on three very difficult lives, Susan.
Yeah. Well, we have, but somebody once told me many, many years ago, if it was easy, everybody would be doing it.
Yeah.
And we're lucky because we just have an incredible staff, and we've worked really hard to find, you know, it wasn't easy for us to find people when we first moved there. Now this is our 13th year we've been there. But over the years, the right people have just somehow turned up there at the right time. And often it was just about when we were ready to give up, you know, when we were ready to throw up our hands and say, oh, this is just too much. We're never going to find this person. We're never going to be able to do this. And then suddenly it was almost like a gift from La Petraia. The person would appear, and they would be the right person, and they would enable us to take it to the next step. But we never got that when we wanted it. We got it when we were ready for it.
Huh.
And that's really, I think, one of the big lessons that, you know, we've gotten from, you know, from this place, from this whole experience.
Well, let's talk about 13 years ago. Two Canadians go into an ancient hillside, and though it was abandoned, you know, what is the suspicion of outsiders like when you take over a historic property like that? And what was it like dealing with, and what is it still like dealing with the famous Italian bureaucracy? You know, I can't imagine that's very easy, especially being Canadian.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it takes a long time to become, you know, for years people thought that we just owned a holiday home there and we came in the summer. After about 5 years, they realized that we actually were living there. But this past year was really a special year for us because the little town of Radin Chianti, where Petraia is located, they have a twin program. You know, a lot of towns in Europe are twinned with other towns in Europe.
Sure.
And Rad is twinned with a town in the Cognac region. And the people from Cognac were coming to Rada this summer for the first time in many years. And the mayor of Rada had to pick one farm and they were just coming for two nights. And so they were posted in families with families in Rada, and the mayor wanted to pick one farm in Rada to take them and show them, and he picked us. And so that for us was really when we really realized that, oh, now the people from Rada, not only do they realize what we're doing, but they're proud of it.
That's great.
And they want to show us off.
That's great.
We are the place that is. And so that for us was really a milestone. And now I think, you know, in our little town and in our little area of Keelanti, there people really do know what we're doing, and they're really proud of it. Because a lot of them remember the days, you know, when every farm was mm-hmm. like our farm, and it's not like that anymore. And so for them, it's, you know, it only took us 10 years, but,
but you're in the community now.
Yeah, that's right.
I want
and
to
then
talk
the bureaucracy, to answer the second part of your question, the bureaucracy there is phenomenal. It's world famous. And it's phenomenal. And in our region of Keelanti, of course, it's even worse because it's area of the EU that's protected right up to the EU level. And so to do anything there, you have to go through your commune, you have to go through your region, you have to go through your province, you have to go through the federal government, and then you have to go through the EU. And if we had known that when we bought the property, we never would have done it. But on the other hand, you know, I can stand out on my front yard there, as you guys have done, and look around me and see a vista that hasn't really changed probably since, you know, for 500 or 600 years. And so there's some wisdom also. We hear a lot about the Italian bureaucracy and how horrible it is, but there is also some wisdom
sure.
to it.
Well, I mean, it's hard for a good idea to get through, but it's really hard for a bad idea to get through. It's harder to denude the land of what it
exactly.
Was.
Yeah, yeah. So it takes perseverance, and it takes you know, you have to be willing to persevere and not give up, and you have to have a little bit of a vision and see that what you're doing is not, the payoff is not going to be immediate, but like most Italians do, you know, I mean, they can look a long way back, and so they're able to look a long way forward, and they're not so
in the moment.
In the moment, yeah, they're in the moment, and they're not so worried about having to get everything done today. You know, they think about things, they take their time, and they make decisions that are not just based on them, but their, you know, the future.
So let's talk about, you know, the moment. You're sitting here on this property that the, you know, there's an Etruscan ruin that's 2,500 years old on, and a 1,500 year old farm. In a 400-year-old farmhouse, and you've taken on that. What I've heard you say is a responsibility. You know, you're gonna be on this property for, let's say, 50 years. You're gonna be tending to La Petraea. You know, that's
gosh,
two. That's
I wish.
That's
yeah.
That's 2% of its life.
Yeah.
So
exactly. Yeah.
So what happens to this property as you move forward? What are your goals for the property? What are your goals to where to get it to?
Well, that's really not up to us. I think it's really up to La Petraea. I think from the very start there, it's been La Petraea that has guided us, and it's been La Petraea that we've listened to. I think our goal is to be, you know, just to increase our sustainability, to be sustainable in all ways. There's, you know, we still, you know, we have a pickup truck on the property. We still use, you know, gas. There's a lot of things to do yet. But it's going to, for the most part, our decisions are going to be governed by, you know, listening, observing, making those decisions each season based on what happens, what La Petraea has given us to work with.
You know, I think when you say that, I'm reminded in your book of what I think is a really beautiful thing that I only discovered in this new book, is that when you found La Petraea after it had been abandoned in the 1950s, and you were walking the overgrown property, you talk about how you found different sorts of trees and different sorts of wild vegetables growing that you believe were the remnants of what was once cultivated there. Is that one of the ways that you think that La Petraea told you what to do with it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and then later we hired a historian to write to do some research and find out what actually had been grown there. And those were the things, the legumes and the chickpeas and brassicas were the things that had been grown there, the things that we observed just growing wild, and fruit, apples and pears. And even still today, you know, we make a lot of decisions about, you know, how we're managing the vineyards and how we're managing the animals and the vegetables based on what we observe happening in nature on the property. As you know, that we have a lot of wilderness that surrounds the property. It's 165 acres. 25 of those we cultivate, and the rest of it is wild forest.
Yeah.
And Marco, who you met when you were there, makes a lot of his decisions. He's our agronomer, about what he's going to do in the vineyards based on what he sees happening in the forest. And so, for instance, this past summer, you know, it was very, very hot in Chianti. What happens typically when it's, when we get this really hot weather is that you don't, trim the foliage in the vineyards, you leave it. You leave a lot of the leaves on. But he went out into the forest, and of course what happens in a forest when it's really hot and when it's really dry, well, you get an early fall. The colors start to change early, the leaves start falling. And why does that happen? Well, that happens because the plant is trying to preserve its energy. The purpose, the main goal of the plant is to reproduce, to recreate, and they want the plant wants all of its energy to go to the fruit. And so if it doesn't have leaves to deal with, then it can direct more of its energy to the fruit. And so based on that observation, we decided that we would reduce the foliage in the vineyards. Well, everyone thought we were crazy, of course. But at the end of the day, we ended up with one of what we think we have yet to see, because, you know, it's still in the... We haven't bottled the wine yet, but we think we have one of the most interesting vintages we've ever had.
Susan, you need to let everybody there know that crazy is a wonderful motivator.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, and, you know, it's funny. What you talk about there really has a relationship to what a lot of people... There's biodynamic agriculture and viticulture, which, you know, we can trace back to Rudolf Steiner, and there are formal schools and intricate thoughts of biodynamic agriculture, but at the basic level, the view of biodynamic agriculture is to view the whole system as an organism, is to view the whole farm as an interdependent organism. And
yeah.
And that sounds a lot like what you just talked about, is going to
exactly.
See the relationship between the neighboring forest and the
yeah.
vineyard. What role does biodynamics play in your belief system and in the way you run your farm?
Well, biodynamics is sort of we're certified organic, and then we moved into biodynamics, and we've sort of pushed past or through biodynamics some. There were for us some limitations to biodynamics, and there were also some incredible things that we've embraced. Rudolf Steiner, of course, came from Germany, and one of the core things about biodynamics are the 9 preparations. And you know, we're a little bit reluctant to. Organic, both the words organic and biodynamics in agriculture have become very trendy and popular terms, and they're words that, you know, you have to pay money to use now. They're not
right.
Part of our language anymore. But there are, in terms of the preparations, there are, things that we just do not have on our property. For instance, stinging nettle and I think yarrow blossoms are another base of one of the preparations. Now, most farms, what they do is they go out and buy those preparations, but which you can do, and you can call yourself biodynamic if you do that, but that didn't make any sense to us.
Because it doesn't come from your farm.
It doesn't come from our farm.
But one of the principles that you did a great experiment with that you cover in the book is what you plant when you planted the squash blossoms, one on a flower day, what is called on the biodynamic calendar a flower day, and one on a fruit day. And why don't you tell us about that experiment?
Well, exactly. So the Maria Toon's biodynamic planting calendar is something that we use. And the very first year that we used it, we decided to plant zucchinis, some on flower days and some on fruit days, because we use both in the restaurant. And so we did that, and then we sort of forgot about the fact that we had done that. And I was out harvesting these zucchinis, and some of these plants just had the wackiest looking zucchinis, and they were all distorted. And other plants had no zucchinis but beautiful flowers, and they were all the same variety of zucchini, so I couldn't figure out what was going on, so I got Marco and asked him, you know, what do you think is going on here? And he said, oh, yes, Susan, these are the ones that we planted on the fruit day, and they had beautiful, perfect-looking fruit and almost no flowers, and the other ones were ones that we had planted on a flower day, and they had were producing very little fruit and beautiful, big flowers. And we've had all kinds of experiences like that. For instance, with root vegetables, we were never able to grow root vegetables at Petraea because Petraea means place of stone.
Right.
And our stone, our soil is very rocky, and even the locals would say to me, Susan, you're never going to be able to grow potatoes or carrots there, you know. And they were always distorted. And it was only when we started planting on the biodynamic calendar and planting our potatoes and our carrots on root days that we started having incredible, perfect-looking root vegetables. And so we've had a lot of interesting, you know, experiments with that. And then in terms of the preparations, you know, we've just taken our own approach to that, which is something I think probably Rudolf Steiner would approve of.
Sure.
And we've, for instance, we use the different manures from, you know, Rudolf Steiner calls for using cow manure and putting it in a horn and leaving it all winter. And well, we don't have cows and we don't have cow horns, and so we use the manure from our pigs and from our rabbits and from our sheep. And, for instance, pigs are animals that like to root. And so we use their manures in areas of the property where we think could benefit from having stronger roots, or maybe the roots need attention.
Now let me ask you a question, because you know that Mark and I have undying respect for you. We see the actual physical produce of what you do. There is no chef that I know of, and we know so many, more connected with the farming of the food that they cook, because, well, you farm all of it yourself, you know, and you built the property, right? So I don't know of any other chef anywhere who restored their own 1,500-year-old farm and garden and livestock and runs it all. So when you speak about this, you speak with great authority. I know you're an intelligent and analytical person with a professional agronomist on staff. So, you know, I know that you what you say is true, and it's not colored with, you know, it's not seen through rose-colored glasses. My question is, though, what do you think makes, you know, what do you think is the science
what's the causality behind,
say, fruit days and flower days? And what does burying a horn in the soil do? Is it about balancing energies and things that we don't understand? Or do you understand it?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story about burying the horn. When we first started down this path, we decided to try burying the horn. So first of all, we had to find the horns. We had to order them from Switzerland. We ordered them from Switzerland, and then we got some cow manure from a neighbor, and we buried it repeatedly. And our dog, Hockley, who you might have met when you were there, we would dig up the horn, no matter where on the property we buried it, and bring it back to to me.
Uh-huh. Proudly, I'm
and
certain.
Yeah. He did that repeatedly, and we, so that was sort of, we had a biodynamic dog, but we decided that this was not working, and it was really that experience that made us start to think about this in a little bit of a different way. I mean, who knows? We're who knows about this stuff, but I think the idea is that there are energies and there are planetary influences. We all accept that, you know, there are the influences of the cycle of the moon, you know, that produces the tides and that produces different cycles of life. So why wouldn't the planets also have some influence on life forms and insects and things like that?
One of the things you were touching on before that I think certainly could have some causality. You know, if you have a pig farm where pigs root, you know, deep to pull out potatoes and parsnips and turnips and things like that, why the presence of their manure may give some signal to those vegetables that they have to be more hardy than they would have to be without that manure.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there may be a signal in there that may, you know, who knows? It doesn't mean it's wrong just because we don't know.
You know,
one of
my favorite farmers, grape farmers in America is Barbara Shin at Shin Vineyards out on Long Island, and she has, you know, I had a conversation with her, and she said, listen, there's some stuff that we don't yet understand why it works. Yet I'm the farmer in the field, and I'm telling you that at least for me, and in the instances where I, you know, talk to other people, it does work.
Yeah.
So should we not do it because we don't know how or what the mechanism is?
Yeah.
You know, and would you agree with that?
I absolutely would agree with that. I'm not an expert in any of this stuff. I just know that what my experience has been there, and I'm very much someone who just intuits from what I see happening around me and growing and I can tell you that, you know, it on that level it has worked.
Well, and it's also, you're making food on the highest order. This isn't just like, you know, bushels of corn that you're selling in the market. I mean, you guys are this is a, you know, this is a, I would think.
Well, and you know, we do look for empirical evidence all the time. Mm-hmm. We do experiments all the time. The other thing about, you know, sort of this systemic approach that we've sort of moved through biodynamics now to something that we call systemica, is that, it's complexity that we're after. You know, it's about something that's changing all the time, that's not static. It's about complexity versus simplicity. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. It's about, you can never really, for instance, 1 year you might just have an incredible year for some things in your garden. And other things won't be so good. And it's not because you failed with those other things. It's because that's what the year gave you. And that's what you have to learn as someone who lives on this planet, is that we can't have everything we want all the time.
But Susan,
I
just need to interject. And if all you grow is corn on your property,
right?
Then all you see is we had good corn this year, we had bad corn this year.
Exactly.
Hey, listen,
exactly.
Susan, we need to take a little break. Will you stick with us and come back on the other side?
Yeah.
I want to talk about meat, vegetarianism, planting a garden in Tuscany, and your beautiful, beautiful inn. Susan McKennett Grant's new book is Dynamica La Patria Cucina Sistemica at Kilometer Zero. You can find out more about it at restaurantguysradio.com. You can visit La Patria, lapatria.com. If you want to learn how to spell it, you got to go to restaurantguysradio.com because I'm not going to tell you. And we'll be back in just a minute. Stick with us. You're listening to us on restaurantguysradio.com.
Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is the wonderful Susan Grant. Susan McKenna Grant is with her husband, owner of La Petraia in Italy. If you're going anywhere near Tuscany and you care about food, farming, or beauty at all, and you don't go stay here, something seriously wrong with you. You're missing out. And her new book, which you can pick up, you can also find at lapetraia.com or go to restaurantguysradio.com. And we'll tell you how to get the book, is Dynamica. It's a beautiful book full of the story of La Petraia. Pictures, because you really need to see it to believe it. Your picture's worth 1,000 words, and you need 1,000 words to see some of this stuff. And also some really great recipes, which you can do at home if you're into this stuff at all. I want to ask you, Susan, one of the things I found that I realized when reading this book, and I didn't realize how revolutionary it was, by the time you got to Tuscany and you planted your garden for your vegetable garden, just the very act of planting a garden was, you know, something to be noted in and remarked upon in the town. Yeah.
Yeah.
How did that come to be? What was that all about?
Well, you're talking about Marco's piece about an orto in Chianti and how I mean, Chianti has always been a little bit of, it's an austere environment. Grapes grow well there, olives grow well there, but it was never really a place where people were really known for their vegetables.
Right.
The Valdarno, which is the other side of the Chianti Mountains, where it's fertile and flat, and it was very famous vegetable growing and fruit growing land. And so there was always this idea that people who lived in Chianti didn't know anything about growing vegetables, you know, that you couldn't grow vegetables in Chianti. The idea of having an orto or a vegetable garden in Chianti was a little bit strange.
Well, you specialize in a little bit strange, Susan. How did this particular endeavor and that work out?
Well, like everything else, you know, it's been a bit, it's taken us a number of years, and it's always, like we always say, you know, the vegetable garden at La Petraia is the heart of La Petraia. It's the place where my heart is there, and I have a lot of my energy invested in that vegetable garden, and it's like, there's a famous Italian saying, which is "l'orto mi fa morto," which is my vegetable garden. You know, it's killing me.
Will be the death of me. Yeah.
it's a constant source of frustration and joy and great joy.
But you are successful. You do get the vegetables for the property, including the restaurant, out of that.
Yeah, we do. We do. We get everything. Every single, all of our vegetables. From the property and all of our fruit,
but not all of your vegetation comes from there. You do still do some foraging from the property.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, tons of foraging. Yeah.
So talk to us a little bit about that and the things that you're finding out in the forest.
Well, we get all kinds of wild. We have chestnuts. We have all kinds of wild stuff that just grows everywhere on the ground there. You know, wild brassicas and flowers and edible, all that stuff, you know. And then we have wild berries and wild apples and wild fruit and wild game. We have a tremendous amount. We have a harvester who comes in every morning at about 6 o'clock and gets a harvest list from me, and she'll spend half of her day harvesting in the vegetable garden and the other half foraging.
So, I love her job is to go out and look for stuff in the woods.
How great is that?
Susan, I'm going to tell you, you know, my dad had the small farm up in upstate New York, and we you know, the garden was literally just that. It was a you know, what we would consider in New Jersey a very large garden. But, you know, harvesting the stuff out of the garden was fun and all, but harvesting the stuff that you went out into the woods and found the wild raspberry bush and harvest the raspberries out of the wild raspberry bush I'm not by any means a master forager, but the stuff that you found, I took more pleasure in the stuff that I found than the stuff that I grew.
Talked to Mark's father, and he also said that, you know, Mark went out and foraged stuff, and he often came back with a stained face. I never got any berries off that kid.
That's right. That's important, though. You have to taste it.
I think that's what the fun was, though.
Yeah.
So I'm not taking a
surprising number of people who won't do that. I'm always after people at La Petraia to do that, because how do you know if it's any good?
I'm not cutting the celery and going, oh, let me get some of that. You know.
Well, all right. So this brings me to the third. We talked about vegetables and wine and olive oil and. We're going to leave the bees and the honey and the mead to another day, which is amazing. Amazing to me that you make mead from your honey. It's a very, significant change that you made in your life. Both you and your husband had been vegetarians from the time you were teenagers until you acquired and began renovating and rebuilding La Petraia. And so you once again became omnivores, and you talk about that in the book a little bit. And not only omnivores, you now can slaughter and butcher these animals that you form a great relationship with. And I thought it was very interesting how you talked about it in the book. Will you talk with us a little about that transition for you and your husband?
Well, yeah, we had been. I was a vegetarian since I was 15, and until we moved to La Petraia, and same with my husband. We decided that when we moved to Italy, that so much of the Italian cuisine and the culture there, especially in our part of Chianti, is, you know, it's about the meat, and we are missing out. We are missing out on an incredible taste. You know, we were just missing out. So we decided that we were going to start to eat meat, but that we had to raise those animals ourselves. And so that's where the journey really began. And it's really been an incredible journey because, and again, you know, we get back to the idea of Sistemica. It's a system. You know, nothing goes to waste on our property. I always tell people when I take them out and show them the pigs that this is where my refrigeration system is, because I hardly have any refrigeration in our kitchen. We don't need refrigeration. Everything that you would normally put in a fridge, we go out and pick just minutes before we are, you know, that day. And anything that we're going to, it's the animals that store the food for us, you know. And so anything that we have left over, they get and they store it. And then when it comes time to kill them, well, we know what they've eaten and we know that they've had a good life. And it's that sort of chain, it's that circle of life, and it really is an incredible experience to do that, and then to give it, to feed it to people, to feed it to our guests and pass that along, that experience.
You talk in your book about the first time that you had, you know, raised your Cinta Senese pigs, and it was time for them to be slaughtered, and the butcher was coming in the morning. You said, yeah, I don't. You initially thought, I don't want to see that. I don't want to be there for that. And then you thought, no, that's not right. That's, you know, if I'm the agent of this, I should be there and see how they meet their maker. And then you learn to butcher. I mean, what was that like, that first when you first came into killing animals and butchering animals from a vegetarian's
perspective? Right. Going from vegetarian to, you know, butchering your own animals is a long
step.
Road.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, when we first saw there's an essay that I wrote about this in the book, when that day when I did decide I had to watch the killing, and that was about 7 years ago now, I think. I've done that ever since, every single year. And it really was incredible because the animals didn't suffer at all. The butcher just came up and you know, really did it in such a beautiful way, and it was like a dance, like watching a dance the way he did that. And then learning how to butcher has really just been another incredible journey because it's the thing that I really had no experience with at all, meat. I didn't know how to cook meat. I didn't know how to butcher anything. And I had to really teach myself how to do that. And I've learned from hunters, basically, how to butcher a whole animal. Because they would come often with a whole deer and just leave it with me. And, you know, I'd have to run after them and say, hey, wait, you know. Like,
what do I do with this?
What do I do with this?
Where's the zip tie?
And then, you know, you learn. And really, it's just about feeling around for the muscles. And you can learn to feel what muscles are going to be, you know, if what muscles are going to be more tender and more suited to this kind of cooking.
Coming into it though, what were your emotions at the watching of the killing of an animal? I think, you know, I'm a dedicated omnivore, but you know, there are a lot of people who think that, you know, chicken comes from a package. And
yeah.
You know, there've been studies that,
and can't eat their chicken if there's still a bone in it.
Right.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
we don't sell bone in, we don't sell whole chickens anymore, and we don't sell French breasts anymore because it grosses people out to see a bone. I mean, some segment. So as we get further and further removed from how our animals are raised and certainly how they're killed, people have had this disconnect between, you know, that, you know, meat comes from an animal, you know, and I think that's really sad, and I think it's I think it's great that you were there for the slaughtering of the animals. Was that an emotional shock to you to see that?
No, it wasn't. It was really actually a beautiful experience. It really was a beautiful experience, and even more complete was that a couple of days later when we all sat down together and ate the meat. It was really an experience I've never had. I've never felt that before when I've felt it many times since then, but when you've actually eaten meat that had been alive just a couple of days before, and it was an animal that you raised, that you fed every day, it was really quite an incredible experience.
First of all, Susan, I want to say that is beautiful. And secondly, I want to suggest that for those of you PETA members listening, the address to write your letter to is Susan McKenna Grant, La Petraia, Rada in Chianti, Italy.
Susan, I'm going to go back to that farm experience I had with my dad again. Isn't it more fun, though, to eat the rabbit that was stealing your grapes?
Yeah.
Isn't that more fun?
Oh, yes, it definitely
Hope
is.
Hope you enjoy
fun.
Those grapes.
Yeah.
That's one of the things.
Those great fed rabbits are especially delicious.
One of the things on the menu when Francis and I were there was grape fed hare. And Francis and I turned to Susan and were like,
that's a joke, isn't it?
What is a grape fed hare? It's like, oh, yeah. Yeah. That's the one that was stealing a grape out in my vineyard when the hunter came and got him.
I love that. Yeah. Hey, you know, Susan, I'm going to pay you a compliment, and I really do mean this. And it's not possible because your restaurant is integrated firmly into the experience of everything you're doing at La Petraia. But if somehow the experience at the table in your restaurant could be magically transported to New York or San Francisco or Paris or London, it would unquestionably be among the one or two best restaurants in any of those cities.
The Michelin people need to visit you.
And I'm serious. It's a Michelin three-star experience. And it's completely unique. And everyone, if you have the opportunity to go to La Petraia and sit in one of its four rooms or sit at one of its, what, four or six tables you have?
Yeah, four or six, depending on the configuration. Yeah.
If you're within 100 miles of Rada in Chianti and you love food, and this is, in many ways, this is still undiscovered. We've been talking about it for years, but it's going to get discovered.
FYI, if I'm within 1,000 miles, you'll see me at La Petraia.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so that's a compliment I want to pay you. Thank you so much for this book. Thanks for coming on our show, and thanks for teaching us all lessons about how to do this stuff.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk to you guys again, and I'd love to see you back at Petraea anytime you're within striking distance.
We'll be there one day, and we'll probably bring bring a microphone one more time. Susan McKenna Grant has two books, Piano, 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 and Dynamica is her new book. You can find out more about La Petraea, staying there, eating there, and reading those books at lapetraea.com. Of course, you can always go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, where you're listening to us, the Restaurant Guys. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis. Amazing book. I'm going to cook some of that stuff at home, as well as sit down with a chef and talk about some of the stuff that's in there. It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
I need to say something. We all live in a world where almost everything around us is contrived.
Yeah.
Okay. We worship a mouse that Disney has put up, and we go visit make-believe castles, and we see princesses that aren't really princesses, and people dressing up, and television is basically a way to get us to watch commercials.
Right.
And that's how most people spend their free time and their leisure dollars. We go see athletes who make way too much money
to throw a ball up and down
to throw a ball up and down a field
for a city they're not loyal to.
Who are generally spoiled brats and unapologetic about it. There is a place in the world that is as real as any place I have ever been in my life.
Yeah.
And the fact that more people don't go to La Petraea, everybody should have a chance to visit La Petraea once in their life. And go see what's real. Go see what life is about. Go see what you miss.
If you're a young student and you're backpacking through Italy, it's not that expensive to stay at La Petraea for one night or to just go there for dinner and stay someplace local.
What I was getting to is for one night at Disney, you can spend less and go spend one night at La Petraea.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so much more magical than the pretend magic that happens in all of these contrived places that we visit and spend our entertainment dollars. Go to a real place. Go do something real. Go see somebody who's the total real deal.
Uncharacteristically for me, I have nothing to add to that. Mark said it all. I couldn't agree more. I hope that you guys have enjoyed this hour as much as we certainly have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com.